Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at oil and governance. While currently the United States, thanks to new domestic recovery technologies, seeing a decline in petroleum imports, for most of the developed world, their daily energy needs are entirely dependent on oil and gas imports, and mostly on energy that comes from a national energy company as opposed to a private international company. While the Exxons, Chevrons, and ConocoPhillips of the world are devoted solely to extracting energy and maximizing profits, state-owned oil companies, on the other hand, often have domestic politics, sometimes geopolitics, as a part of their overall mission. And given that nearly three-fourths of the world's oil and gas reserves are in state-owned energy hands, that causes some to worry. Well, my guest today has done an exhaustive study on the impact of state-owned oil companies. Mark Thurber is the Associate Director for Research at the Stanford Program on Energy and Sustainable Development, and he's the co-author and editor of Oil and Governance, a 2012 book looking at the impact of state-owned oil. He'll be presenting the University of Tulsa's Collins College of Business Energy Lecture tonight at 7 o'clock in Terrell Hall Auditorium. I spoke with him about a week ago by phone, and we feature the conversation today on Studio Tulsa. Mark Thurber, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. I'm happy to be here.
You'll be speaking on the effects of state-owned oil and gas companies. And this is like the Gazproms, the PDVSAs, and the Aramcos, and, well, many, many, many oil-producing countries have these state-owned oil companies. And for people who work in independent oil companies, international oil companies, this is sometimes a subject of concern, as state-owned oil and gas companies own about 73% of the world's oil reserves and about 68% of the natural gas reserves. Is this something to be worried about, the fact that so much of our fossil energy is in the hands of state-owned companies?
Well, what I would say, so there are a couple ways to look at that. One is, as you're saying, from the perspective of the private oil companies around the world, should they be worried about these national oil companies or NOCs as their competitors? And then also, I think people worry in other capacities about it as citizens. Should we be worried that these national oil companies are somehow threatening our national security or threatening the security of the oil supply around the world? People might worry, do NOCs affect oil prices? And do they affect the environmental impacts from oil? And so what I would say, we can go into some of those topics, but I think often those worries are overstated because from the competitive perspective, NOCs fill different niches usually from private oil companies. And then from some of those other perspectives, I think there's less concern needed about questions of security than people might think.
Well, let's talk about the missions of those companies. For private oil companies, it's a pretty simple goal. You extract energy, oil, natural gas, and you try to sell it at the biggest possible profit. For national oil companies, that's one goal, but they have an awful lot of other ones as well.
That's exactly right. And that's, to me, that's the fundamental thing that makes an NOC different. Is almost always they'll have some commercial goals, just like the private oil companies that we know, but there's always something layered on top of that as well, because the government invariably has some other goal that they're trying to satisfy from the oil sector. And these goals can be highly variable. This could be that they want their national oil company to subsidize domestic fuel, which is always politically popular. Maybe they want it to provide a source of employment. That's very common. Some of the big NOCs around the world, for example, some of the Chinese NOCs, the government sees them as a way to provide jobs to people. Sometimes they could provide direct advantages to people who are close to the government, so well-connected people might get some special benefits for allocations of oil or other kinds of benefits. Some people think that in some cases these NOCs might support foreign policy objectives of the government. So there are a huge range of objectives, and that's part of why these companies are so different.
And in some cases, they're perhaps the country's most stable state function.
Exactly. And so that's something that you'll see, is that in cases where these NOCs are among the more competent of institutions in a state, that the state may use them for a variety of purposes. So one example is Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez has used PDVSA, the NOC there, as a way of supporting kind of development objectives, you know, doing other things that normally other branches of the government might do. And of course, leaders are often thinking about how doing those things through the NOC will support their own survival and power, because these are things that maybe are very popular with certain voters. So you're right. I mean, I think that's a very interesting function. And even within the oil sector, sometimes the NOC will become a regulator of the oil sector in addition to an operator in it. And of course, this can lead to some conflicts of interest where the NOC might regulate in such a way as to give an advantage to itself relative to competitors. But surprisingly, some countries have made this model work for them in a broad sense.
Now, do you see times when the national oil company differs in policy goals and actually has conflict with the government because they might have differing goals?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that, you know, governments often form NOCs because they think that they will be much more pliant agents than maybe private oil companies. And so a lot of NOC formation was in the 1970s, and it became sort of a fad, and it supported nationalist ideas at the time. But the whole rationale was that these international companies are exploiting us. We don't know how much they're really getting out of this as far as the revenues and costs, and we just can't understand that because we kind of have to trust them. So let's form a national oil company, and then essentially, because they'll be part of government, our goals will be aligned, and we'll know everything that they know. And it hasn't worked out quite that well, as governments might have wanted it to in some cases, because even though the NOC is owned by the government, it develops its own goals. And so, for example, coming back to the issue of employment, the goals of the government might be, well, we want to create a lot of jobs in the company that we can give to people because unemployment is a problem in our country. But the goals of the company managers might be, well, look, we want to be a good oil company. We don't want to just employ everybody and their cousin. We want to employ the people who are good so that we stand up well in the peer group of big oil companies around the world. So, you know, for example, I suspect even in a place like Saudi Arabia, where it's in some sense very closed, and certainly there's not a lot of public information about what's happening within Saudi Aramco, I suspect that those tensions exist, that within the oil company, there's a desire to employ the best people for the job, but then the government has sometimes priorities and tension that we want to just employ people because young Saudis need work.
And of course, the other aspect for many of these national oil companies, in some countries, they're producing, if not a major, I mean, a majority of the government's economy, you know, the economic resources of the country. And in some countries, maybe not quite that much, but a significant source of revenues for the country.
Exactly. And one example is very close to home is Pemex in Mexico, yeah, which is estimated to be at least more than a third of government revenues. And sometimes people say 40%. Because the tax base in Mexico is still narrow and not well developed. And this can also pose a big challenge for the oil company. I mean, this is a thing that Pemex has had to deal with over the years, is a lot of different players in the Mexican government have looked to it for different functions. And one of the most important functions of Pemex is to supply a lot of revenue for government budgets. And so the Ministry of Finance in Mexico has looked to Pemex to do that. The unions in Mexico look to Pemex to supply certain kinds of jobs. The politicians sometimes look to it as a national symbol that they can point to. And all of these conflicting priorities can make it pretty hard to run an oil company, and especially hard to plan for the long term. You know, the oil business, as you know, is a very long-term business, and it's a very risky business. And it can be hard to take strategic risks if everyone in government is looking to you for their own priorities, but no one's looking at the big picture.
And I think that's a common thing when we think of national oil companies, is that they tend to be risk adverse and not really efficient as well, as certainly than, say, the private sector.
Yes, I think that's broadly true. And of course, there's great variation, as we talked about earlier. And one of the reasons why it's just hard for any state-owned enterprise, in some sense, to be as efficient as private enterprises, and the reasons come down to incentive structures. That one thing, if I'm in a private company, I'm always under threat for survival. So I know that if I don't grow and if I'm not efficient, I could get taken over. My shareholders could sell their shares to another group that wants to replace me as the manager, or I could go bankrupt if I can't pay my creditors. And so these kinds of incentives create very strong pressures for efficiencies, for cutting costs, for making sure that the geological bets that I'm making are as likely as possible to pay off. And so just naturally, national oil companies aren't going to have those same kinds of drivers because they're not susceptible to bankruptcy or to take over. What can happen is if they overrun their budgets, the state can complain, but they ultimately can fill the budgets with tax revenues. And so I think as far as pure efficiency, that's where a lot of the differences come from.
But still, you hear international oil company types or even just private oil companies worry about the fact that there are not a whole lot of plays that don't involve national oil companies. Have you found that to be the case?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, I think a big challenge for any oil company, and this includes both the big private oil companies that are searching around the world for opportunities, and interestingly enough, it involves some national oil companies that are looking around the world for opportunities. So they both face a problem that there aren't a lot of spots on the oil patch that are accessible. So, you know, a number of places, I mean, if you look at Saudi Arabia, where much of the world's cheapest oil is, that's off limits to outside participants. Mexico has been largely off limits. There may be some move towards change in that respect. So access is a big problem. And I think it's why you see companies will operate in countries that are difficult operating environments, like Nigeria, but they're still relatively open to outside investments. So this is a challenge for everybody, and I think that the Chinese NOCs, you know, like CNOOC and CNPC, they face some of this issue too, that when they try to go abroad to find oil, there aren't a lot of places they can go.
Now, one of the things your research has pointed out that international oil companies, the Mobils and the Chevrons and Shells and the like, they're much better at managing risky investments, and they do a much better job of analyzing the risk and hopefully managing the reward. Do you see any sense that NOCs and these national oil companies relying more on IOCs, international oil companies, to sort of manage that risk for them as their oil fields and gas fields mature? And they need to start thinking of more risky ventures.
Yes, yes, I think that's right. And so that's a thing that we've identified, and there was some work that I did with Peter Nolan, who has a lot of experience in the oil industry. And in our work, that was one of the things that we identified that did differentiate the international oil companies from most national oil companies, not all, was this ability to manage risk. And I think it comes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, is that the reason private oil companies tend to be good at managing risk is because they have to. They face a situation where if they can't manage the risk of making sure that I'm going to find oil when I explore more often than not, making sure that I'll be able to sell this oil or sell this natural gas to a customer at a price that will recoup my investment, they have to be good at it because otherwise they're out of business. And they have to be good at it in order to compete around the world for opportunities. So they have to convince governments that they're more likely to be the one that's going to find this oil or gas than the next person, and so that the governments should trust them to do the exploration and extraction. They have to convince the capital markets that they're a good bet to invest capital in these ventures. So again, it comes back to these incentive structures that tend to make the private players good at managing risk. And as a result, the governments, when they have an investment that's particularly risky, cases where it's unknown how much oil and gas there might be somewhere, cases where the technologies are very much on the cutting edge, you do see them turning back more to the international oil companies, whereas cases where risks are lower, so mature fields, kinds of activities that maybe the domestic NOC has done for a number of years, they'll tend to rely more on their NOCs. So this is what really creates the sustained niche for the private players, is this ability to manage this risk well. And that also includes managing big projects, managing cross-border risk, and all those kinds of things.
Of course, one of the risks for private oil companies is you take that risk, you help develop the resource. The national oil company can basically at any point say, well, thanks very much for doing that.
Yes, absolutely. Here, it's called the obsolescing bargain.
Yeah, here's a payoff for helping us come up with this. Now we're going to sell the oil. You know,
right,
pay you off
right.
for your trouble and hit the
yep,
door.
And that's exactly right. And that's a dynamic that as you point out, it does happen. You know, and often what will happen is, well, we're not going to exactly kick you out, but we're going to unilaterally change the terms to something we like better. And, you know, I think in some sense, you know, one of the checks that keeps that from happening more than it does is to the extent that countries realize that they need this expertise and need this risk management and need this investment, they'll have a repeating game idea in mind, is that, well, we want you to help us with this natural gas field today, but we're probably also going to want you in 5 years to do another activity, and in 10 years. And so, you know, I think that's part of what the private oil companies have to bank on, is that governments want and need them there over the longer term.
My guest today is Mark Thurber. He's the Associate Director for Research at the Stanford Program on Energy and Sustainable Development. He's also a co-author and editor of Oil and Governance, a new publication. He'll be speaking about the effects of national oil companies in the Collins College of Business Energy Lecture tonight at 7 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the TU campus. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's shift to another area that you mentioned at the start of our talk, which is national oil companies used as geopolitical weapons or for geopolitical purposes. Certainly, we remember Gazprom cutting off the gas to Eastern Europe. That was an economic issue of a dispute over payments and the price of gas. But certainly, that's a big fear, I think, when you think of energy. You know, going back to 73 and the oil embargo by OPEC, that national oil companies can use energy as a geopolitical tool.
Yes, and so that's certainly a big concern in the public consciousness when you think about these foreign state-owned companies. I think by and large, it's overblown the extent to which countries can actually use NOCs for this purpose. And I think a thing that muddles the issue is that leaders of countries will often talk this up as a way to play to their own domestic audiences. And so I think certainly this is something that Russia's government has done at times, has really sort of used Gazprom and its own resource riches as a way to try to assert itself in a foreign policy sense, but probably also playing to the domestic political audience about the country's strength. And I think Hugo Chavez has been another example where there's certainly been a lot of bluster about using NOCs as geopolitical tools. For a number of reasons, it's hard to really do that to a significant extent. And I'll look at those two examples, Russia and Venezuela. So in the Russia case, as you talk about, there certainly was a gas cutoff that had serious implications for parts of Europe and especially kind of Eastern Europe. And so I think that causes worries about the security of gas supply from Gazprom. But the reasons that if you look deeper into it, Gazprom has quite a strong interest in preserving exports to Western Europe, frankly, because that's where the vast majority of its own revenue and by extension, the government's revenue comes from. That Russia domestically is a huge user of natural gas, but that gas is very deeply subsidized. And so it's not a money earner for Gazprom or for the country. And so there's a case where if you look deeper, no one in Russia, and especially on the side of Gazprom, has a strong interest to permanently damage those relationships with gas and gas consumers. And so I think a lot of what was happening with some of those disputes with Ukraine, for example, is in some sense it's almost a high-stakes price negotiation with a transit country for the gas. And so it's not that the foreign policy element is totally absent, but I think it's overplayed, the degree to which companies and countries can really deploy this. You know, and another thing, as I talked about, is sometimes the interests of the company and the government are very different.
Well, I was going to say, though, at the time that happened, we were seeing a gas price spike. So all of a sudden, the government is getting all these new revenues that they hadn't maybe counted on. Does that make it easier to use that as a geopolitical force?
Well, I think what can happen is when oil and gas prices go up, if you think from a government perspective and a government that's earning a lot of revenue from these oil and gas prices, you can get your revenue increase two ways. One is a price increase and one is a quantity increase. And so when prices go up, governments tend to be less worried about keeping the quantity exactly as high as it can be. So if I'm making a certain amount of money today and prices go up by a factor of two, then I can make the same amount of money with half the production. And so I think what that dynamic does is it kind of decreases the premium that governments place on finding someone who can very efficiently manage the oil patch and manage risks. And so I think you're right. I think it gives governments a bit more freedom to take a hard line with foreign oil companies. And so this is certainly something that I think we've seen in Venezuela as well, where, you know, when prices went up, the government was more willing to change terms unilaterally. But if you look a little deeper into that, even that's an interesting case because Chavez had a lot of bluster around how he was going to use the country's very, very extensive heavy oil resources as a way to create a new multilateral counterweight implicitly to the U.S. And other nations. And so really that he was going to use this to create this multipolar world, as he talked about. And if you looked at the early plans for who was going to develop this heavy oil, they invited in the NOCs from Russia, from China, from Vietnam, from Cuba, from all of these perhaps ideologically aligned countries. But then ultimately, it turned out that these players just didn't have a lot of experience with heavy oil. And so he was limited in his ability to use his resources for geopolitical reasons by the fact that oil is risky and difficult, and especially frontier activities like heavy oil. And so ultimately, this places a constraint on how much countries can use their NOCs for these kinds of purposes.
You brought up something just a moment ago I'd like to spend the rest of our time on. That's the environmental aspects, and you mentioned
yes.
Subsidized domestic production. And this is,
yes.
You know, in for so many ways, this is, while, you know, it helps the poorest member of a country's economy have fuel, this is bad from an environmental aspect because it encourages residents to waste fuel. It certainly has environmental impacts, and also from a greenhouse gas effect. There have been some analysis that suggest that if we just got rid of subsidized domestic production of oil and gas, that you might make significant drops in greenhouse gases overall, just
yes.
because of overall efficiency, people being efficient about using energy.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so, I mean, that's one of the most damaging aspects of how energy markets are set up in a number of producing countries is that domestic consumption is very heavily subsidized, which is politically quite popular because the populace will say, well, we've got all this resource, we deserve to get something out of it. And cheap energy is in some ways easy for the government to give. And often the tool through which the government gives this to the population is the national oil company. Now, often the national oil company is not exactly delighted with the fact that they're having to subsidize all of this fuel. But yes, I think the whole system, in some sense, where you subsidize domestic fuel through NOCs is very environmentally damaging. And once you have it in place, it's hard to reverse because there's a lot of resistance to taking it away.
Well, you saw so much through the third world and the developing world when wheat prices went up and all of a sudden bread prices went up. I can't imagine what the reaction would be if gas prices went up, you know, doubled or tripled in a lot of these subsidized economies. It would be
yes.
politically untenable.
Yes, the reaction is not good, as you say. And so it's a real struggle. I mean, it's a real struggle for governments because they face different forces. They face this political force of people rioting in the street, which is, as you say, exactly what happens when you raise fuel prices significantly. But they see other things, too. They see the budgetary hit on their own economies of the subsidy and on their own government, especially their government budgets. And then another thing, if you think about a country like Iran, where the regime depends very heavily on revenues from oil, but oil, you know, gasoline and diesel consumption is very heavily subsidized. What they're doing is they're cutting significantly into their potential for export revenues because there's growing domestic overconsumption because of subsidies. And so I think a regime like that is really in a vise because you look out and you say, gosh, if this keeps up in 5 or 10 years, we're going to be a net oil importer. And then where's our government going to be? You know, maybe it'll be a different government. But then on the other hand, you know, increasing fuel prices is very unpopular. And so, you know, actually the Iranian government has done some reasonably skillful things in trying to phase out these subsidies in ways that didn't bite them too badly. But this is a huge problem for all these governments, and they know it.
I want to ask about another aspect of your work. You've been looking at how we can best deliver energy to low-income populations. You did some studies in India, and this was looking at biomass fuel and stoves, which I guess biomass is used a lot for cooking, and it, you know, it's done inefficiently. It causes health problems and the like. And you've done some work on maybe a better way to deliver these sort of biomass fuel stoves and making it a little more environmentally as well as healthy for the low-income populations.
Yes. So for a long time, people have known that it's very unhealthy to burn biomass inside your house, which is normally what's happening in probably over 1 billion and maybe closer to 2 billion households around the world. That's how cooking is still taking place, a very traditional method. And so there's technology to have cleaner burning stoves that aren't going to cause those very serious health problems from having smoke in your house. That technology has existed for a while. And so one approach is to have a stove that still burns wood, but just burns it more efficiently and more cleanly. Or another approach is to actually move to a cleaner burning fuel, which could be a petroleum-based fuel, like liquefied petroleum gas, LPG, is a much cleaner option. So there are technology approaches for doing it. The difficulty is getting people to actually want those improved stoves. That's especially the case with these improved biomass stoves. And then with the LPG kinds of stoves, there are difficulties with availability of the fuel or the cost of the fuel. And so I think a lot of where the important work needs to be done and is being worked on is figuring out, you know, how can we institutionally deliver a product to people that they'll want and in a way that we can sustain it? And so one thing I think people are increasingly looking at, can commercial business models scale more effectively than big government programs?
Mm. Well, this will be the subject of the Collins College of Business Energy Lecture tonight at 7 o'clock. Mark Thurber, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. It was a pleasure to be here.
Mark Thurber is the Associate Director for Research at the Stanford Program on Energy and Sustainable Development and an editor of Oil and Governance. He'll be presenting the Collins College of Business Energy Lecture tonight at the University of Tulsa campus. The lecture is free and open to the public. It begins at 7 o'clock in Tyrrell Hall Auditorium on the TU campus. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.